Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Wilson House again. And this is so fortunate to have Chris and Dave here. This message, especially the ones that were here last night, really carry the message where it should be. And every morning when I get up, you know, I gotta give thanks to God and my Jesus Christ for bringing me into AA to start the day every morning. I gotta acknowledge that. Just a couple of things here. A little history of the house. Right up there, you see a board, and we don't have it labeled yet. That's the original bar. And that is, I think, 9 feet long, 21 inches wide, a foot in thickness. It's rough cut on the backside, hand planed on the front, and there's not a knot in the whole board. You can't find those anymore. So you look up there, you're thirsty, that's the bar. And this is the back of the bar right here. If you come up afterwards, you can see the class, the lower ones where they lock up the liquor, the money draws up there. If you look real on that side over there, you'll see where the beer opener was. So when you look up here, I think that's a nice place to have the AA literature today. But just a little thing. This is a little story that goes way back about Bill's grandfather. This is Grandfather Wilson. And this story takes place, and this is around the time of Prohibition. And Prohibition was pretty big up here. Everyone was signing the pledges. There was marches. And this town was close to 2,000 people then. It had 5 bars in town. And this was quite a town for people. In fact, when the train came by, you saw a large train station there. They would warn the people on Friday or on Saturday night, be careful, this is a dangerous town. And come sundown, you know, they'd all start drinking. And this town was made up of two people. They were made up of the marble people who just loved to work in the marble mines, and also the local farmers. And when the sun went down, you know, they'd love to drink and they'd get there, and then maybe 10, 11 o'clock, there's always big fights, and that was the whole thing, the fights. You know, that's what they did on Saturday night. They were all heroes, they were all men. And so what they do? They fought. And the next morning at church, you know, there's black eyes and bruises, but everybody was happy. And this is what they did. So this is the type of town. And this is being one of the finer bars in town, in fact, the best bar in town. This hotel, we have a hotel register out in front that was given to us. It started in 1925. I didn't think much of it when it came here. But right on page 3, it has Bill Wilson and wife, Brooklyn, New York, Bill's grandmother, underneath where they came here to visit. And this book covers a 3-year period. And in that book is Charles Lindbergh's signature, Clara Bow from the old silent film days, Myrna Loy, a lot of Chrysler family, and some other famous people. So this was quite the hotel. But when it's getting close to Prohibition and Bill's grandfather, Grandfather Wilson, was known, number one, as a town drunk and also the town scholar. He was also brilliant, but he also loved to drink. And on Prohibition, and this church over here, one Sunday they call in a pastor, and I should say for a weekend, just like these guys are doing here, for the preaching, and the bars closed down. They just didn't dare to keep them open. So it came Sunday, and it was a nice day, and Bill's grandfather decided to go up on Mount Aeolus, and he went up, he's going to go up there for the day. And this, I don't have proof of. We know this happened. I first heard this story from Bill's sister. And he went up, and he carried a bottle in his back pocket. Well, there's no proof of it, but if you're an alcoholic and love to drink, you're not going to go out on a Sunday after going away for a Sunday without a bottle in your back pocket. So we're going to assume he had one, and it's true. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he comes down off the mountain, and he heads right for that church over there. And, of course, it was jammed. And the doors were closed, and he got there, and he just kind of threw the doors open. He had a message. He had a determined look on his face. And he strides down the aisle with his big stride, and people just aghast. He got to the pulpit where the preacher was. He told the preacher to get down off that pulpit. And the people just didn't know not what to do. They were just petrified. And he got up there, and for the next hour, he talked about the blinding white light and what God said to him. And he delivered a tremendous message, and he never drank after that. And it's just the white light that Bill got. And also, too, it kind of affected Bill. I'll have some more stories probably tomorrow about the early history here. But here's Bill with a crackpot grandfather, and, you know, who got religion and stopped drinking. That's just a little bit of our AA history. And it is, and that touched a little bit in the book of Bill, my name is Bill W. Just another little story that we're going, this is a real ancient story. This goes a little bit farther back than Bill. This goes back to biblical times. And I told the story today at prayer. And so I said, gee, this is a good time in the big book to go into it. And this was about a person that had a demon in him. And every day he'd call out to God, God, remove this demon from me. You can call it alcoholism. I like to think it's alcoholism, or whatever you like. But that demon just tormented this person. And he got up this morning, and God was right overhead, and God heard his call. And he came down to see what was happening to this person. And the Lord saw the demon in him. And the Lord got out of his room and swept his house clean. And the demon went flying into the sky, away from him. And this person was so overjoyed and happy. And the demon started flying over the mountains, over the oceans, to find another place to live. About a year later, and by the way, he picked up 7 more demons, all looking for homes along the way. About a year later, he got to the place where he got kicked out of. He looks down, and there's his old home there. He says, let me go down and take a look. And he went down, and guess what? He found the house empty and sparkling clean. And he and the other 7 demons went in to live forever. What's the message on it? Think about doing step 4 and 5. You sweep the house clean, but what are you going to fill it with? See, this person never gave thanks to God, and he never filled it with anything. And when you do 4 and 5, think, what are you going to fill it with? 6, 7, 8, and 9. And that's a promise that's happened to me, because I didn't have a God like him in the program. And it was just 4 and 5 that cleaned the house, and so God can come in. Now, when I start getting rid of my defects, and start, and the 8th and 9th step, asking God to forgive me for what I did to his people and my shortcomings or character defects. I like to call them sins. It's real good in the early book and in the big book. So that's just something to think about when you're doing today about filling the house. And just one more thing, and I'll let these guys get going. In the second meeting room prayer room, I'll set up a little exhibition there. I got some original big books with Bill's signature, and we have a first edition, first printing that Bill gave to Leonard Strong with Bill's signature in it. We got a second edition like that. We got some original manuscripts. I ask you when you're there, there'll be stuff we say, just don't touch. It won't hurt it today, but over, let's say, 50 or 100 years, you can imagine what it would look like. And we keep these things very well protected. So there'll be some other things, there'll be stuff you can get your hands on. Now we got the original letter, a copy of the original letter. Back in the old days, they only had 3 copies of the manuscript, typewritten copies and carbon copy. And we got the copy of the transcript, which is sent to Bill Whalen, Bill's best friend in East Dorset, of the letters between Yale University and General Service about Bill turning down his award, his doctorate award that Yale wanted to give him. So we got a few things like that. So anyway, I'm going to turn the program back over to these guys and enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So anyway, let me start this thing out formally. My name is Dave Frederickson. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to welcome you all back here. Last night, we stirred the pot. We asked a whole bunch of questions. One of the things I like to start the morning out is did anybody have any weird dreams, any drunk dreams, anything bubble up through the unconsciousness from what you heard here last night? Yeah, go ahead.
Am I on an airborne?
Yeah, here. Talk into this thing.
I actually had a lot of dreams. I actually got airborne in my car at one point, and I had my boss in the car with me, and we were looking for a place, and I realized I was going the wrong way, and when we turned off, she said we could go this back way, and as soon as we turned off, the car broke down. And I had one other dream in relation to being at a meeting, and I was inappropriately dressed, and somebody gave me something to put on.
Interesting. The reason I like to ask that question is you always get some strange things from people, and you never know how this stuff is going to affect you. Like we shared yesterday, when Chris and I were talking last night, we're going to cover a lot of things that you may not have heard before in this program. Don't let anybody read your big book for you. We're going to talk specifically out of this book. If you can't reconcile it with your big book, then disregard it. But if you can, pay attention to it, because this is where our program came from. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is this textbook. To get through this weekend, you really only need one thing, and that is an open mind. I'd like to start out with a couple real quick quotes. One of the early authors that a lot of that Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson relied on, one of them was a guy named Emmett Fox. And if any of you guys have listened to Dick B, he talks a lot about the early required reading. There was required reading if you worked with Dr. Bob. And one of the books was Sermon on the Mount, which was written by him. And so I started reading Emmett Fox. And he talks a lot about having an open mind. And it's kind of interesting. He says, have you an open mind? Is the window of your soul open to fresh air and sunshine of truth to come in, or is it closed and shuttered by mental laziness or emotional congestion that we call prejudice? None of us knows how many fine things have been missed through being self-satisfied and cocksure. No one can be considered really intelligent who does not have readiness to examine new ideas with an open mind. The history of scientific discovery shows that most every new step was opposed by the very people who should have welcomed it. Probably the only incorrigible fool is the man who says that anything is impossible, or that there is any limit to the conquest that divine intelligence working in mankind can achieve. And he also makes a statement. He says, it is the change of the soul that matters. The mere acquisition of knowledge received intellectually makes no change in the soul. In other words, what Chris and I are up here talking about is a bunch of knowledge. It will not do you any good unless you put it into practice. Go out. If we show you something in this program, show you something with the steps you've never tried before, by all means, go out and try it. Don't sit with the knowledge because it's no good to you. Go out and have your own experience with it. That's our whole message here. Go out and try this stuff, and you will become a changed person. The other thing that for those of you who weren't here last night, one of the things I've done is I've gone and I've added a lot of our history to this workshop. And it's the books that nobody ever wants to read. A Comes of Age, Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old-Timers. So I'll be making references to pertinent stuff that comes from that. And one of my favorite guys that you heard me talk about last night is a guy named Harry Thiebaud. And from A Comes of Age on 309, he wrote, the works of Alcoholics Anonymous has threefold aspect. First, the group has weekly gatherings where experiences are related and problems discussed. Second, all are urged to read their book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which contains their basic tenets and must be read if someone is to arrive at an understanding of their program. Third, the members work with prospects who are making their initial contact with the group. Helping others is a two-way situation, since it not only assists the beginner in his efforts, but also aids the helper, who derives from his efforts something which is essential for his continued sobriety. So that's why I'm here, because you guys are helping me, you know. On page 105 of AA Comes of Age, it says, we have two authorities, which are far more effective. One is benign and the other is malign. There is God our Father who simply says, I am waiting for you to do my will. The other authority is named John Barleycorn. He is saying, you had better do God's will or I will kill you. And sometimes he does kill. So when all the chips are down, we conform to God's will or perish. At this level, the death sentence hangs over the AA member, his group, and AA as a whole. Therefore, we have the full benefit of the murderous political dictatorship of today, but none of their liabilities. So there was authority enough, love enough, and punishment enough without any human being clutching the handles of power. For us, it is to do or to die. And that's what we're going to be talking about. What are we supposed to be doing in AA? What does this book really tell us? And compare that to what is it we've been doing in our sobriety? How does our program stand up to what the book has told us? This is what Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson did. So let's find out how our programs compare to that. And that's our goal, to get as close to their footprints in the snow that we can. Do exactly what they did, and we'll get exactly what they got. You know, in the big book, I talked about it just a little bit last night on the title page. In the old editions, there used to be the circle and triangle, which is on the steady editions on the front, which we've now removed from our big book because of copyright violations. One of the things I didn't talk about is the symbolism in that circle and triangle. Circle represents the whole of AA. You know. And if you take the triangle out of the hole, what are you left with? Big zero. Nothing. And inside there's three sides of this triangle. It's an equilateral triangle, meaning that all three sides are the same length. So in theory, if you believe the circle and triangle, and as I was taught by my sponsor, that you need the three parts of A in equal proportions. You can't be all in the steps, or you can't be all in the traditions, or you can't be all in the concepts. On the three sides of the triangle, there's recovery. There's 12 spiritual principles for recovery. That's the 12 steps. There's unity. There's 12 spiritual principles for unity, and that's our 12 traditions. You know, one of the things that I've done in my sobriety is I try to practice the traditions at home in my family, and it works phenomenally well. You know, I try to have a balance where I'm not just all 12 steps. I add the traditions in. For example, our common welfare should come first. You know, just because I'm the father in the household doesn't mean I'm in charge. What's the best thing for the family? Because I'm a self-centered alcoholic, I'll always do what's best for me. You know, and it was having an effect on my family. And as soon as I changed my attitude towards it and said, hey, let's do what's best for the family, it changed my family. Just the same way, if the 12 traditions can keep a bunch of drunks like us from killing each other, why wouldn't it be able to work within a family of people that love each other and help eliminate the strife that goes on in the family? You know, each member should be self-supporting. You know, that means physically, emotionally, you know, we shouldn't be overly dependent on each other. Yes, we love each other and we get mutual things from each other, but we should be whole human beings. We should bring a whole person to the table. I mean, right down the line, the traditions apply. Let me service. There's 12 spiritual principles from service, and that is the 12 concepts. A lot of people have never heard of the 12 concepts. Don't even know that there's 12 concepts in AA. They're there. They're in a book. Some people have never seen this. This is the old version of it. This is the AA service manual. You know, there's also 6 warranties. A lot of people have never heard of the warranties, but they're in here. Great reading. A little tough sledding in the beginning, but there's some really good stuff. They've just redone the service manual. It's a much easier format to read. You know. Anybody that's been sober for a while, you should know what's in there, because it's what keeps us going. It's how to run a business meeting. It's where the concept of substantial unanimity comes from. I practice the 12 concepts at home. I have a little, he's about to be 5-year-old, you know. When we take a group conscience, a group family conscience, and we say, Mom and I might say, hey, let's go out to, the Thirsty Turtle for dinner. And he'll say, no, I want to go to McDonald's. He is the minority opinion. That's what our service manual says. Service manual says he gets a chance to pitch his idea to the group a second time. The majority does not. And I'll be amazed at how often the presence of God steps into that family and we listen to his opinion, even though it's the minority opinion, and it becomes the majority opinion, just like in AA. So I understand, because I've got experience with practicing the 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts in my life, and it's made me a more rounded, more whole human being. Really neat stuff. AA comes of age. It says the circle stands for the whole world of AA, and the triangle stands for AA's 3 legacies of recovery, unity, and service. Within our wonderful new world, we have found freedom from our fatal obsession. AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of recovered alcoholics in action. We must carry AA's message. Otherwise, we ourselves will fall in decay, and those who have not been given the truth may die. This is why we so often say that action is the magic word. Action to carry AA's message is therefore the heart of our third legacy of service. You know, I think it was a crime that they took our circle and triangle off of our literature. You know, one of the very first things I do when I'm 12-step with a new guy is I sit down and I explain to him, just like I explained to you, that there's pieces to this program. You can't live all in the fellowship. You can't just come into AA and take up a... You can, but your sobriety is going to show it. You just go to AA meetings, you take up a chair, and you go home, and you're miserable to your wife, you're miserable to your kids, you're miserable at work, and your life is miserable. You know, on the last page of Bill's story, he describes his life as utopia. Is your life utopia? Have you found that promise that's in this book, if you do these things? If not, maybe you're missing a piece of the triangle. So compare it to your sobriety, compare it to your life. Is AA everything that you want? You know, if it's not, it can be. You know, what's missing? That's the circle and triangle. Before we get into the big book, you know, one of the things I forgot to do already this morning, I'm not out of sync, is the whole purpose of this program is about getting together with a higher power. So why don't we get quiet for a second? We'll go ahead and say set aside prayer. To ask God to remove whatever your concept of God. And by the way, anytime we talk about God this weekend, I don't care what your religion is or lack of religion, whatever your concept is, it'll work for this weekend. But the whole purpose of AA is about finding a higher power. So why don't we ask that power to come in and be with us after a moment of silence, and then we'll turn it over to Chris, and he'll start us through the doctor's opinion. All right? Father, I ask that you come into this room and be with us. And please help us set aside everything we think we know about this program and this big book and the 12 steps. Give us the faith and the courage that we need to face our life and our sobriety and have a new experience with these things, Father. Keep us safe and protected as we go through this day. And keep our eyes open to having a new experience. Amen. So Chris is going to take us through the doctor's opinion. First question we have to ask ourselves is, who is the doctor? We talked about it last night. From the fourth to the second edition, it says that Dr. William B. Serkloff is a New York specialist in alcoholism. He's now accounted as no less than a medical saint to AA. Right? What makes him a medical saint? Well, he worked with thousands and thousands and thousands of alcoholics. I've heard numbers from all over the map, and it's one of the questions I get asked on almost every workshop, so I bothered to finally dig it out. I've seen numbers from as low as 15,000 alcoholics up to the highest number I've seen so far is 63,000 alcoholics that this guy worked with. AA Comes of Age, on page 14, it says, Dr. Silkworth was the director of towns, and he treated 40,000 alcoholics. But then if you go to Pass It On, it says, in his lifetime, the doctor has talked to over 50,000 cases of alcoholism. So the man knew his stuff. In 1935, when Bill got sober, actually 1934, I guess it was, the end of 34, when he was entered town for the last time, Dr. Silkworth was the world's preeminent expert in alcoholism. If you wanted to treat somebody for alcoholism, anywhere in the world, everybody knew the town hospital in New York was the place to go. And this is one of the guys that brought us this program. You know, based off of that, it tells me that I need to pay attention to what this guy said. You know, he had some pretty interesting ideas. And the National Council on Alcoholism meets down in Rutgers University now. And from what I understand, everything that this doctor studied in 1935, and it was his theory at the time, none of that has been able to be disproved with current changes in medical science. This guy knew what he was talking about. He was dead on with today's technology. So let me turn it over to Chris and let him take you through the doctor's opinion.
Okay. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. When I was first exposed to this book, it was in rehab back in early 1989. And I remember seeing this doctor's opinion, and I knew how old this book was. And I said to myself, what pertinence really can a doctor's viewpoint from 1938 have any alcoholism has a spiritual treatment? This doctor's opinion has a lot of pertinence, In this opinion, he's basically going to say that he can't do anything for you if you've gone down the scales of alcoholism too far. That would be like going to a stockbroker today and asking for their advice and having them say, well, you know, it would probably be better if you go down the block. There's a couple of guys that flip coins to make decisions on stocks. I mean, it's almost unheard of that a doctor would send you away. Even today, it's not very usual for a doctor to send you away. They'll usually try to treat you. And basically what they'll be doing is treating your symptoms. They'll be treating your depression, or they'll be treating your suicidal tendencies. The thing that I get out of this doctor's opinion, the amazing thing I get out of the doctor's opinion, is his honesty. He had treated, let's just say, 35,000 alcoholics, which is a lot of alcoholics, and he'd seen an amazing amount of suffering. And he was willing to admit his defeat in the hopes that this personal recovery program that was spreading around would be able to relieve some of the suffering that he's seen. It's just amazing that he did that. And I believe the reason he didn't sign it in the first edition was because he could have been made the laughing stock of his peers. You know, I mean, how much were they were being charged? They were charging like $200 for a detox visit back in the 30s. And you know, for him to admit that it's probably not going to make a difference. Probably wouldn't have been a real good resume highlight, you know, for him. Anyway, it says he's from XIII, a well-known doctor, chief physician in a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. I'm going to skip to the second letter. The first letter is just basically some introduction. And it says that you can trust what the alcoholics say, because he knew these people personally. So he's just kind of giving his recommendation. But let's go to the second letter. I have a feeling that when he gave, Bill Wilson asked him for a letter, and he gave him this little letter, and Bill said, well, you know, could you give me a better letter than that? Because it says here, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views, which is probably what he was looking for in the first place. Anyway, it says here that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. One of the things that is still very, very prominent in the understanding of the alcoholic is what is going on with us? I mean, how many times has your loved ones looked at you and said, why are you drinking yourself to death? What, are you nuts? You know, I've found through my own experience, unless you are an alcoholic and you've experienced the powerlessness of alcoholism, it's very, very hard to understand it. I'll give you an example from my own experience. A friend of mine is in OA, and she's a food addict. Now, this is something I just know nothing about. But she told me one time, she goes, you know, I started eating a piece of cake the other day, and I ate two whole cakes. And I just thought to myself, you slob. You know what I mean? You glutton. I don't understand the phenomenon of craving when you start to eat flour products, because I'm not a food addict. And so I have a misunderstanding, which she explained to me. let me tell you. But so I'm just using that as an example. Unless you've experienced the phenomenon of craving and the obsession of the mind, it's a very, very difficult concept to grab hold of. You will think we're weak-willed. You will think we're bums. You will think all kinds of things. The great thing about Dr. Silkworth was he was really defining the problem in our nature. And he says, we're sure that our bodies are where it's sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical fact is incomplete. So he talks about the body and the mind. Let's go over to XXV about three paragraphs down. I'm going to read this paragraph, and then I'm going to translate it into something that I can understand. Remember, this is a doctor writing around 1938. He says, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we're perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. When I first read that, I really didn't understand what he was talking about, but being an alcoholic, I figured I knew anyway. You know, but getting a hold of a set of Joe and Charlie tapes early on in my recovery, they explained it a little bit, and that's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to take this from 1938 Dr. E's and put it into something that I can understand. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual experience was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but the spiritual experience application presented difficulties beyond medical conception. What with the doctor's ultra-modern standards, the doctor's scientific approach to everything, we doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. So he's really kind of admitting a little bit of defeat here. How does a doctor apply the power of God in a 15-minute office visit? You know what I mean? One of the things that is very discouraging, I believe, for treatment facilities, it's also very, very difficult to try to convince you that your answer is going to be God. Because normally what they do is they give you a lot of information. They teach you a lot of things about alcohol and how it affects your body, and they give you tons and tons of information. What the big book basically says is it says that you need more than anything that can be solved by humans alone. You need a form of higher power. And this is something that the doctor is admitting. And it's really outside of his scope. That's really wonderful. I go down about a paragraph. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell us his story to other patients here, and with some misgivings, we consented. This is after Bill Wilson sobered up. I love that. He requested the permission to tell his story, and with some misgivings, we consented. Today, they're knocking down the doors of AA to get us into the treatment area to tell our story, because they know how valuable it is for us to bring our experience of recovery in. But back then it was not so. Down at the bottom, of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. I just want to describe the craving for liquor. When Dave and I are talking throughout the rest of today and tomorrow, when we talk about craving, we're talking about the body after the first drink. What happens is alcohol metabolizes in a certain way in an alcoholic, and it creates what is known as the phenomenon of craving. And simply speaking, that's the second drink takes the third drink. The third drink takes the fourth drink. By the time you have the sixth drink, you want the seventh drink more than you wanted the second drink. It gets worse and worse and worse, this physical craving. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. An allergy is something that confused me for a while, because I had an allergy to chocolate when I was younger. And I would eat chocolate, and I would break out in hives, and my throat would close. When I drank alcohol, I felt larger than life. I could talk to women. I got rid of all my fear, and I could dance. So I couldn't really equate the two with an allergy. But one of the definitions of an allergy is an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And I'll tell you what, if you take five normal people and me, and you put booze in all five of us, an abnormal reaction is going to happen in me. I do things like wake up in Topeka with one shoe, you know, and the abnormal reaction is basically that I don't stop. When somebody used to ask me, "Do you want to go for a drink tonight?" my first thought is, "What's on the agenda tomorrow, and can I miss it?" You know what I mean? Because I know when I get into the deal, I got to finish it, because it finishes me. You know, I don't have two beers and go home to the wife, you know. That's not the way I drank.
For me, I had a hard time with this, because everybody that I drank with drank like I did. You know, so they'd say, "Well, what was worried about you drinking?" And I said, "Nothing. We all drank that way." It wasn't until I looked back at when I first started drinking, you know, back in the Boy Scouts when I was maybe, I don't know, 10, 12 years old, we stole some booze, I had an abnormal reaction. Everybody else drank a six-pack and started to throw up, which is a normal reaction. I drank a six-pack and was taking everybody else's beer that was left over and wanted more. You know, everybody else woke up in the morning and was all hungover, and they said, "Yeah, I'm not going to do it that much ever again." I was thinking, man, that was not nearly enough booze. Next time I'm going to make sure we have two cases. You know, that's where it finally hit me that I had an abnormal reaction. Because by the time I got to the point where I was drinking regularly, everybody drank like me, and there was no mirror to hold it up against.
That's very, very true. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average tempered drinker. A thing that threw me is I knew a lot of people who used to get the phenomenon of craving, and I don't consider them alcoholic. They were heavy drinkers. I went to rehab with several of them. They had to be detoxed from alcohol. They couldn't get away from alcohol. But once they were detoxed, on their own willpower, they could keep from picking up a drink, and they've done so for long periods of time, without their lives being, at least to my knowledge, really unmanageable. So the phenomenon of craving, you don't necessarily have to be an alcoholic to have it. It doesn't occur in an average temperate drinker, but it can occur in a hard drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence and their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's an understatement. I mean, anybody that's getting to the point where they're about to go to rehab, you have some problems. You know what I mean? And you want to tell people about them. And I remember being in group in rehab. I used to get upset because I didn't have enough time to talk about my problems. You know, everybody was talking about theirs, but I want to talk about my problems. Okay, let's say you're trying to deal with this person. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Won't you please stop drinking? Won't you stop drinking for me? Yeah, right. Yeah, sure. Won't you stop drinking? You have such a lovely wife. I love that one. You know, that's later on. I never could understand those concepts. Anyway, the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. And that's really what I've been trying to develop in my 12-step approach, depth and weight. I've tried to cut out the stuff that separates me from the alcoholic and concentrate on the stuff that the alcoholic can identify with. Let's go down to the bottom of the page here. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. That's a bingo for me. I was in the process of drinking myself to death, understanding it as my normal reality. You know what I mean? I thought that this is just the life I've chosen. This is where I am. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Here's a great example of the unmanageability of life. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I went to many, many first-step meetings, how I understood the unmanageability of life was because I wrecked 9 cars, had 3 DWIs, lost my family, and had 13 jobs in 10 years. You know, is that unmanageable enough for you? I don't really believe today that that's what they're talking about. I believe the unmanageability is a spirit malady. I believe the unmanageability is all the little problems that pile up on us and become astonishingly difficult to solve that are in our emotional nature. You know, what exactly is it that we're uncomfortable with? Why are we uncomfortable with ourselves and our environment all the time? That's a beautiful description of an alcoholic who's unrecovered. Anyway, he says here that we're restless, irritable, and discontented unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which everybody else can take without having any problems. You know what I mean? I'll tell you what, it happened before I took a drink. See if anybody can relate to this. I just make it through work. I'm starting to suffer from DTs. I want to get to a liquor store so bad. It's 3:30 and you are ditch food if you're in front of me doing the speed limit. While I'm on the way to the liquor store, get out of the way. I'd get to the liquor store, I'd get home, I'd crack that bottle, I'd pour it on a bunch of ice, and I'd feel a sense of ease and comfort before I even started drinking, you know? I knew that this is the medicine that I needed. After they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And how long does that last? You know what I mean? How many times have I sworn I am never, ever going to drink again? About an hour later, well, I'm not going to drink today. About an hour later, I was pretty extreme this morning, making a decision never to drink again. That was a little bit uncalled for. And I would slowly talk myself back into drinking, because I was a daily drinker. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. An entire psychic change. I'll tell you what, I have had an entire psychic change, and I am now a recovered alcoholic. I don't suffer from the things that we're going to be talking about in the unmanageability section. I mean, I have my ups and downs. I'm human, and I go through life, and I take my ups and downs. But as far as the unnatural uncomfortableness of the alcoholic, I'm recovered from that. And it's been through the process of meetings, steps, and service that my spirit has been healed. And it's, like it says later on, it's a daily reprieve. I understand I need to maintain it, but I now know what that psychic change is. down at the bottom of the page. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to that date. He's now talking about the mental obsession. He went over the craving pretty well, but let's just look quickly at the mental obsession, because he's talking about it here. What is that? Why do we pick up the first drink? Knowing what we know, knowing that we end up in Happy Hills with a wristband every time we drink, you know, why do we continue to do it? What is it? How do we talk ourselves back into it? And I believe I'm powerless over this kind of thing. I believe that the power comes from God to relieve this mental obsession, because there's just some amazing things that have happened in my life about the mental obsession. I'll give you one quick example. When I was in like seventh or eighth grade, there was this guy named Huey. He was huge. I was about 90 pounds soaking wet, you know, a little pre-alcoholic wise guy, you know. And you know, like any alcoholic worth their weight in salt, you got to pick on the big guy, right? This guy was huge. He was like 220 pounds in eighth or ninth grade. And he was kind of a dumb, quiet guy. And I used to pick on him. And we had these hall lockers. And what they were was they were combination lockers. And one of the pranks that you would pull is you'd sneak up behind the person getting their books out of the locker and slam the door shut. And they'd have to go, oh, you know, and sit there and fool with the combination again, and you'd get a good laugh as you're walking off down to your class. Well, I slammed Huey's locker shut he was having a bad day this time, right? And I slammed his locker shut, and let me tell you what he did. He turned around, and he grabbed me by the shoulders, and he started slapping my head up against the concrete blocks in the hallway. Just slam, slam. He knocked me unconscious, and I woke up after third period had already started. You know what I mean? I come through on the floor. I'll tell you what, I never, ever again slammed that guy's locker shut. You know what I mean? If I was walking down the hall and he was in his locker, I'd go all the way to the other side of the hall just in case somebody else slammed it shut and he'd turn around and see me there. And if he was over there right now going through his locker, I wouldn't slam it shut now. You know what I mean? There was an adequate mental defense that kept me from slamming that guy's locker shut. Right? I'll tell you what. Alcohol knocked me unconscious every day for the last 10 years of my drinking, and I kept slamming that locker shut. What is it? What is it? That's the mental obsession. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue the fight. And I choose to interpret that meaning we get to a point in our alcoholism where we choose suicide. We choose suicide because we just can't go on. We lose a lot of people. Down at the bottom here, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This is what makes us alcoholic. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these three people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It's never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The body after the first drink will never improve. If we started passing around whiskey right here, the phenomenon of craving would most likely crank in just like it did, or even worse, back when we were drinking. That's something that's never going to get better.
You notice it said that this allergy differentiates these people as a distinct entity and sets them apart. That means an alcoholic is completely different than anything else. And if you don't believe it, try taking a drug addict and getting him admitted for treatment. And don't say he's an alcoholic. Just walk up and say, you know what, I got this guy, he's a heroin addict, I want to get him admitted. Insurance companies won't pay because he's a heroin addict. But if you go up and say, hey, this guy, you put a cord into him, bring him up and say, hey, this guy is a drunk, they'll start to pay for the treatment. They'll pay for alcoholism, but they won't pay for drug addiction. Even an insurance company knows there's a difference between alcoholics and drug addicts. Now, a lot of us are we have everything. We're garbage heads. I'm one of those, you know. You know, my drug of choice is more. Just give me more, whatever it is. Make the pain go away. You know, but it's an important thing to realize that there are some very specific, separate differences of alcoholics that don't exist in other people. You know, if you're just a pure alcoholic, you know. The problem is there are very few of those around.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I'll tell you what, the hard thing, the really hard thing to convince a new alcoholic of is that he has a mental obsession, that they have a mental obsession. If you can get to a deep level of truth with someone you're working with about the mental obsession, you're going to find that they will motor through the work. If you come to the conclusion that there's nothing you can do, you will pick up the next drink. You can't just wish it away. You will pick it up unless you undergo a spiritual experience. You might be looking for that spiritual experience a little harder. You know what I mean? Another example from my own experience about how I couldn't keep from drinking, even though it was the smartest thing in the world to do. I'm getting my license back. This is like the mid-80s. I'm getting my license back from a third DWI. Okay? I walked for almost like 8 years because of these DWIs. It ruined my life. I'm finally getting my license back. And I had to go down to anybody that's gone to the Motor Vehicle Bureau know what I'm talking about. They just drive you crazy. You have to have millions of forms and everything. It's got to be signed and paper. I finally had all my ducks in a row, and I was going down to Wayne, New Jersey to get my license back for my third DWI. And I don't do real well with crowds or authority, unless I have a couple of pops, you know what I mean? So I had a couple of shots of vodka, and I'm off to get my license back. So I drive down there, you know, to get my license back. And I walk in, and I finally sit down in front of this woman, and I have a resentment against the motor vehicle. Anybody here ever have a resentment against the motor vehicle bureau? I go in there, and I go, I've got this, and I've got this. I'm like throwing down all this paperwork. I finally know I got her, and she's got to give me my license back, right? And she goes, she starts sniffing me. She goes, have you been drinking? I go, no! She goes, I smell vodka on you. You're drinking vodka and you're getting your license back for a third DWI? She's looking at me like I'm insane. She goes, did you drive here? I go, no, my girlfriend brought me. She's downstairs. I'm a smell from the night before. She's looking at me like I'm insane. Finally, she has to give me the piece of paper that I walk up to the window and get my... She has to, right? And she hands it to me, and she doesn't let go. It's like a tug of war. And I'm going, give me that. She was trying to protect humanity from me. I'm getting my license back from a third DWI, and I'm drunk doing it, and I'm going to drive home probably. You know what I mean? If I had any power over whether I drank or not, would I have done something so stupid. You know what I mean? I was powerless over that, you know? I mean, I needed a couple pots to go get my license back. It sounded good to me. Anyway, the doctor understood some of this stuff. So he, you know, he's laying out a great introduction. He's saying, please pay attention to this stuff.
And the very last two lines in the doctor's opinion. He says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. How many doctors have you ever been to in your life that have told you, hey, I can't help you with your problem, go home and pray? You know? Pretty amazing, you know? We got started a little bit late because of Ozzy, so we're going to go ahead and take a break now. It's 10 o'clock. Why don't you guys come back at 10:10, and we'll finish up to the top of page 23, which is the end of craving. And then we'll jump right into to the rest of it. So see you at 10:10.